From Buck Studio, Wisconsin Public Radio, this is Zorba Pastor on Your Health. I'm Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor, here to talk with you about what's new in healthy living, share some down-to-earth advice, and some great lifestyle tips to help you get the most out of life. If you have a question for Zorba, you can call us now at 800-462-7413. Along with their calls, some interesting topics to talk about, Zorba.
Yes, we're going to talk about those standing workstations and desks and whether or not it really increases your activity and your energy expenditure throughout the day.
And
FDA is targeting sugars and sugar in this food supply, things that are sweet that we don't even know are sweet. What shall we do about it?
Coming up, our number again is 800-462-7413. And our recipe, Zorba.
Yes, chicken kale salad with apples and cheddar. It is delicious.
Now, let's get to the phones and see what our first listener has to ask or say. Billings, Montana. Hi.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure. How can we help?
Well, on September 18th, I stepped on a sewing needle, a very small sewing needle that my husband had used to pick. He wanted to pop his blister in his hand because he works a lot, and it was just a water blister or whatever. And I accidentally stepped on it. Probably went about 1.5 centimeters into my skin. I pulled it out, no blood, and I've just had pain ever since. So about 2 weeks after that, I went and got a tetanus shot because I was still feeling a lot of pain and I was concerned about it. And then that didn't help it either. So I still have pain. It hit the ball of my foot kind of right in the middle, I guess. But I still have some puffiness on the top of my foot. And it still bothers me moving the foot, you know, toes and stuff. So I was just curious if you had any insight.
Yeah. So how many weeks since the injury, the actual injury, how many weeks out are we?
Oh, my goodness. I would say at least 7.
Okay, so you're within less than 12 weeks. That's kind of an important point, that 3 months. Now, why did he leave the needle out? Let's look at your husband's motivation for leaving the needle out there.
Well, he left it on a windowsill, and I was partially to blame. I was cleaning up around
Wait a second. He left it on the windowsill? Now, what were you doing with your foot on the windowsill?
Knocked it down.
Okay, it was actually in the bathroom, and I guess he was probably sitting on the throne doing this to his hand, and I was wiping up in the bathroom, cleaning up, and it fell on our big, fluffy bathroom rug.
Got it.
So
okay.
I really didn't see it at the time.
I just want to kind of paint the picture for the listeners on how it is. Big, fluffy bathroom rug, bathroom. We've all been there at one time or another. Stuff actually occurs.
Yeah.
That's where
a
lot of stuff, and that's where our feet are bare when you think about it. The bathroom, by the way, is a major point of injury throughout the house. It is the most likely place you're to injure yourself, knock your head, have a heart attack. It's most likely to occur, and a stroke.
Fall down
in a bathroom. Fall down. I mean, bathrooms are dangerous places. We should stay out of them. I think we should just stay out of the bathroom, and we'll be okay because we won't have those injuries. Clearly, you know, when the needle pierced your foot, it went through some nerves, some muscles, some ligaments, so they were destroyed partially. You know, they were injured, and then the bone itself. What are you doing in terms of walking on it? Do you have little pads, you know, those Dr. Scholl's pads that are used so you don't walk on that area?
You know, I tried that at first, and the first day it felt great, and the second day I put it back on, and it was like, it didn't affect it at all.
You only put on one pad?
Yeah, around surrounding the area, like a donut.
Sometimes you have to put on two or three. You just have to do that. And then you have to put on a tight sock, almost a support stocking, so it doesn't move. And you've got to find out. And sometimes you have to put a pad on a different part of the metatarsal. The metatarsal is what we walk on there. That's the end of our foot before our toes begin. And sometimes you actually have to get a metatarsal pad so you're walking a little differently while this thing is healing, because that's the issue. The issue is, you know, getting rid of the pain while you're actually walking. So I go to Dr. Scholl's. I'd spend about $10 or $20. And I get a bunch of different pads to see how you can walk. And when I got up in the morning, the first thing I would do before I got to bed was put this on. That's what I would do. And I would
Can I get it at a drugstore?
Sure, of course you can. And the only time I would take it off is when I was showering, and I would shower with, in all seriousness, with things like Crocs. They've got a nice foam in there that makes a big difference. It's bouncy. And I would not walk barefoot at all. Are you walking barefoot?
Occasionally, yeah.
Nope, no barefoot at all. What you want to do is you want to have the pads on as close to 100% of the time. You want to take it off when you're going to shower, obviously, if necessary. You know, you don't actually have to remove the pads if they say sticking, but most people will take them off. Wear Croc shoes, something with a bouncy sole, get back on, and just do that. It takes 12 weeks for these things to heal. You're well within a healing, you know, within a healing zone. Taking any ibuprofen or Aleve?
Yeah, I was the first couple of weeks.
Yeah, I'd probably
bring the swelling down.
I'll tell you, if it were me, I would take two Aleve twice a day, two generic Aleve twice a day. It'll reduce the swelling and the inflammation and get rid of the pain. This is most likely going to heal. You've just got to stay off of it as much as you can so there's less pain during the healing. And just follow that advice. It'll work. And tell your husband to stop bringing those needles into the bathroom. If he wants to do a project, it's in the basement.
Tell him, yeah. Okay.
Okay.
All right. Well, thank you very much.
Thanks for your call.
We appreciate the call. Thank you so much. 800-462-7413 if you have a question for Zorba, as does a listener now in Wichita, Kansas. Hi.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure. How can we help?
Well, I have a question about the differences between tea and coffee when it comes to caffeine and antioxidants.
Uh-huh.
I'm not a coffee drinker.
Oh,
so.
Well, that's unfortunate. What happened? At a young child, you got turned off by coffee? Is that it?
Zorba wants to hang up on
come you from a number of coffee teetotaler families, or is it a religious conviction? As you know, there are certain Mormons do not drink coffee or caffeine. So.
No. Yeah. I have tried to learn to like it. Uh-huh. You know, I first didn't drink it, it was not always considered a good thing. It was kind of thought of a bad habit.
Yeah, that's right. Well, that's what I mean. But, you know, coffee used to be shunned as a bad habit. But the Dutch, back in the 1600s, introduced coffee into America. And prior to that, the New Englanders, their beverage of choice in the morning was a glass of rum. So coffee was considered a good thing because they were no longer drinking rum. I would not suggest, by the way, that you go from, since you're not drinking coffee, that you drink rum.
But maybe both.
That's very... there you go. There you go. First of all, caffeine, it varies to some extent from bean to bean and how you brew it. So you can have more coffee, you know, espresso. If you look it up on the internet, I don't remember exactly the number of milligrams, but, you know, there's espresso that has a certain number of milligrams per ounce, and then it has regular brewed coffee, a cup of coffee, 8 ounces or 12 ounces, you know, in tea. And these are general numbers, you know, when you look on the net, and like I said, I don't have them memorized, you'll see it. Coffee generally has more caffeine than tea, but tea does have caffeine, and caffeine, of course, is added to a bunch of products in the U.S., all the energy drinks pretty much so contain caffeine. I mean, you know, generally, not every single one of them, but most of them contain caffeine. So, but you can get, the Brits drink tea, but they brew their tea strong. My grandfather used to take two tea bags and an 8 ounce cup, and it was very bitter, and he would then put in lemon, so it bitter with lemon in it,
goodness.
And that was that's what he drank. But he was Brit, he was English, and he called that tea, whereas my mother would have tea, and it would be sort of like barely visible in the cup. Yeah. So is that what, why do you want to know?
Well, because years ago figured out I'm really sensitive to caffeine.
Uh-huh. Yeah, not unusual.
Mm-hmm. I also have discovered that it does help.
Yeah, of course.
You know, I figured out that I would go to work with no caffeine, and I was working with people who'd already had 3 or 4 cups of coffee.
Right.
And now, when I do my morning puzzles, if I get stumped, I get my caffeine, I drink iced tea all year round sometimes. Oh.
And iced tea is great. You know, it's a good way to get your caffeine. I think if you can't do your morning puzzles, then wake up and have a little cup of coffee.
Wake up and smell the coffee.
Thanks. Good luck on those puzzles. They're important to keep your brain going.
Well, thank you. I guess I'll keep trying to learn to like coffee.
That's right. And for antioxidants, I'd head over to blueberries. They are chock full of antioxidants.
I do those.
Chock full. So thanks so much for your call.
Well, thank you.
Take care now.
Bye-bye. 800-462-7413. Before our next call, Zorba, people are working standing up more and more and more. Sometimes kids at school are learning standing up. And now we have some research on
it. Yeah, there's stand-up desks. There are a number of people. I'm in a large medical clinic who use stand-up desks. They find it's better for their back. I mean, that often is a motivational issue. Mm-hmm. Now, there are other people who have stand-up desks where they're on a treadmill, where they're actually walking slowly.
At work?
At work.
Are they getting any real work done?
Well, it's not a fast treadmill. It's like, it's like 1 mile an hour or 2 miles an hour. And there was an article in the British Medical Journal that actually looked at treadmill activity and how much energy you would expend in an 8-hour day, and it showed that you could lose 10 to 20 pounds if you kept your caloric intake in check. I kind of doubted whether or not people who walked on treadmills actually would do that. But anyway, but this is an interesting article published in Medicine and Science, where they looked at people who were actually either on treadmills or standing up walking. They were looking at their daily activities. So they're either standing. Most of them were standing. Some of them were moving a little bit. Mm-hmm. And discovered something very interesting, that even though they were standing more at work, they were sitting more at home. Standing more at work, sitting more at home. Now, it didn't come up right away. It wasn't like the first week or the first 2 weeks of the first month where you're gung-ho, you're ready to do it. Wow, I'm standing up at work. I'm going to get up. But over time, they became lazy and slothful and became couch potatoes at home. So now they were standing up at work, they were sitting at home. And they measured the activity with an accelerometer. These are things that are in Fitbits and Jawbones, the thing that I have. And it really was pretty accurate. So the net gain, when you're 3 months into it or 6 months into it, tended to be zero.
Zero.
Zero. Stand up at work, you sit more at home. Now, the question is, why is this going on? Does the body reach sort of a physiological state and then the subconscious says, hey, I've been standing up at home, I'm going to take a rest and do less at home? I don't know. But it may not answer the full question. We know unequivocally now, sitting for long periods of time at home or at work is not good for us. Standing up is good for us, and sitting for long periods at home or at work is not good for us. I mean, we kind of know this. So the idea that we're sitting at a computer for 8 hours, we know isn't good. And you should stand up and move around. We know that.
Yeah.
But it may be that the stand-up desks do not give us that much of a net benefit. And maybe we should look at what we call the blue zone people. There was a great book written by a gentleman. I've only read I've read reviews of the book, and I've read some summaries. But basically, he looked at people who had good longevity, less heart disease. And they found out that every 20 minutes, they got up and moved around. That was just their nature of what was going on in the house. And that's what we should do. They didn't have stand-up desks in the middle of Croatia, where they live until 102. They just stood up when duty called.
Yeah. Well, should we do the show standing up?
Yes, right. Right. We may show on our Facebook page standing up doing the show, but I think because we're sitting in microphones, we'll have to stand up and bend over, and that may give us neck pain.
We could do the show, you standing up and me sitting up.
Yeah, we could do that. That actually would be the case. There you go.
800-462-7413. That's 800-462-7413. And now, Zorba, let's see if we can help a listener in Durand, Wisconsin. Hi.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I've got a 10-year-old autistic son. He keeps breaking out in hives. It's like he's allergic to something. He doesn't swell up. His airways don't swell up. It seems that if we give him like an oatmeal bath or give him Benadryl, usually within 30 minutes it clears up and goes away. But we know he's allergic to something, so we want to try to get it narrowed down so we know what's going on. We've talked to a doctor, and they said the only way they can test him to find out what he's allergic to is to bring him in, and they have to give him multiple shots.
Mm-hmm.
Is there an easier way, less painful way, obviously with an autistic child, to do this? They have some kind of contraption. When they give him the shot, it's just not one. It's like 10 different needles in one.
Right. And that actually is the most accurate way to try to find that out. But there are other things involved. Hives can come half the time that we look at hives, maybe even three quarters. We don't find a reason for why they're happening. They can be caused by a virus. That's the theory right now, mm-hmm. where people will have hives, and then over time, it just dissipates. It gets better. Or we find out they're allergic to everything. And, you know, there's the other extreme where there are tests and there are positives. There's sort of everything. And then you go to what do we eliminate? And you eliminate things, and then they go away. And then you reintroduce them and they don't cause hives. So it's not one-on-one. In other words, it's not as if you'll get the test and then find out the answer. And it's only been going on, it's not a long time for people with hives. So my first recommendation is, how many times a week is this happening?
I'd say probably two or three times.
Mm-hmm. And then how long does it last when it happens?
It depends. If we don't give them any like Benadryl or give them the oatmeal bath, mm-hmm. it can go on for probably 4 to 5 hours,
okay.
and then it'll start going away on its own.
Yeah. Are you giving him Benadryl at night every day?
No.
Yeah. You know what I would suggest before? Because the most accurate way is with needle testing. They can do patch testing where they just put it on the skin. It's not as accurate. You have to talk to your allergist about it. That is another way of doing it, but then you have to wear this stuff on your skin. And sometimes the needle testing is more accurate. You do it once, and it's like any other injection. You then have to, you know, deal with the aftermath. But I think if it were my child, what I would initially do is say it may have been a virus, because there really is a good chance that that's what it is. It's going to dissipate over time. I would give Benadryl at bedtime for probably a month, 1 or 2 months. That's what I would do. I'd give maybe, how old is your son?
10.
So I'd probably give 25 milligrams of Benadryl at bedtime. Does he swallow pills or take liquid? Will he do that for you?
He'll take the liquid. Good luck on the pills.
Okay, so liquid. And then I would in the morning, I would give him a liquid non-sedating antihistamine, or Benadryl at a 10-year-old may not bother him. A lot of children can tolerate Benadryl. Adults can't. Doesn't make them sleepy, but for kids they do. And I would try it in the morning. If it doesn't make him sleepy or side effects, I'd give him the Benadryl twice a day. I just do that for a month or two, see what happens. If it decreases the hives, then I would slowly get off of it, and it may just disappear. Because you've got an autistic child. It's bothersome, but it's not life-threatening. I think putting off anything that would really disturb him is a good idea. And since there's a good chance this may go away, I think I would just treat it with antihistamines for a bit and see what it does.
Okay. Yeah, that was my biggest thing. You walk him into a doctor and you show him a needle and
he's gonna freak out. Yeah, he's gonna freak out. That's right. So I think I would just treat him for a while and see what happens. They do tend to go away over time, you know. And like you said, you know, you're looking for food. There may not be any food at all that's doing it. It just happened post what we think is a post viral infection, an inflammatory type reaction. It's not life threatening. Let's see what some Benadryl does. Okay.
Okay.
Thanks. Let us know. Send us an email and let us know or give us a call back. I'd like to find out what goes on with this, okay?
All right. Thank you, sir.
You're welcome. You take care.
Thank you so much. We appreciate the call. And before we take a break, Zorba, time again now to hear from your favorite fault finders, the Grammar Police. But every once in a while, a new branch of well-intentioned nitpickers pops up. Here's an email from Paul in Curtin, Texas, who appears to have started his own splinter cell of quibblers we will call the Insect Police. Hi, Dr. Zorba. You and Tom quite literally complete my day, so a term you have used nibbles at me. Many people describe an encounter with a fire ant as a bite, but from several years of personal observation, I will grant that fire ants do bite, but that small bite is merely to give the ant an attachment point from whence it will curl up and plunge in its stinger.
Oh, wow.
And
I didn't know
this
that.
This sting, rather than bite, delivers a tiny amount of venom, which causes the pain.
Hmm.
Do you think us Texas farmers wear boots and long-leg jeans because they're cool and comfortable? Think snakes and fire ants.
I mean, I think cool and comfortable, because a lot of them live in the city. They don't have snakes and fire ants.
I still but think they're kind of cool and comfortable.
Absolutely. So this little ant takes a bite, and after the skin is open, it takes and delivers its sting.
Exactly.
How intelligent is that? It's saying, get away from me and get away from our house. I love it. I love it. I have now learned that some of the grammar police are insect intelligent.
Ooh, very good. If you'd like to enlist in the ever-expanding Zorba police force, send your grievances along in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org or post it on Facebook.
Hang around. We have the recipe coming up. Also, lots more of your calls, our medical myth buster later in the hour, right here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRI Public Radio International. Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. That number again is 800-462-7413, and we'll get to the phones right after we find out how to do chicken kale salad with apples and cheddar.
That's right. So, do you like kale? Kale is not. It's not on your top list.
The rest probably of that on your sounds bottom. Great to
How
me.
How about apples?
Apples, yeah.
How about cheddar?
Cheddar, sure.
So think of kale as sort of a filler. Cheddar, that's all.
Got it.
It's filler, see. Yeah. But some people like kale. Now, I like kale in moderate amounts, but I don't like kale all the time. Of course, my mother never fed me kale, and kale was just kind of used to make other things look good.
So you don't like kale very much.
I'm a moderate kale user, mild to moderate. I'm not somebody who goes, wow, there's a kale salad. I can't wait to dig in. On the other hand, I don't like iceberg lettuce anymore unless it's like a wedge salad, iceberg lettuce is tasteless. You know, if you look on the balance scale, you've got kale on one side and you've got iceberg lettuce on the other side. That's not what it is. So start out with one bunch of kale. Remove the stems, tear it into bite-sized pieces, and a bunch is going to give you, I don't know, 8 or 9 cups of kale. So there's a lot in a bunch.
Okay, a bunch of kale, stems removed, torn into bite-sized pieces.
That's right. Teaspoon of Dijon mustard.
Little tea Dijon mustard.
Teaspoon of honey.
A little tea honey.
2 tablespoonfuls of sherry vinegar.
2 big tea sherry vinegar.
And you can get, I have different vinegars around the house, and I have a champagne vinegar. They all taste different. I mean, balsamic, sherry vinegar, wine vinegar. Wine vinegar will work here, but you want a robust vinegar. Sherry would be good. Champagne would be okay. A 1/4 cup of extra virgin olive oil.
1/4 cup extra virgin olive oil.
You can use, of course, some kosher salt and ground black pepper.
Some kosher salt and ground black pepper.
Okay, so for the apple, you want to use 1 big apple, which is about 1.5 cups, and you want to cut the apple into kind of like little matchsticks, make them small.
Got it. An apple cut into matchsticks.
Now, how many people who have never smoked know how big a matchstick is? You know what I mean?
I think most people know how big a matchstick is. Yeah,
they've seen it somewhere in their life, like when they were camping.
Campers.
So what if you've never camped and never smoked and lived in New York City? Do you know what a matchstick looks like? that's what it is.
We'll hear from some New York City people.
I bet we will. 3/4 of a cup of white cheddar cheese. I would use the sharp.
3/4 of a cup of white cheddar cheese.
Okay, now sharp, remember, there's chicken in here. 1.5 cups of shredded rotisserie chicken. I love rotisserie chicken. I love it. It's an easy fix. It's wonderful. It's simple, and you shred about 1.5 cups.
1.5 cups of shredded rotisserie chicken.
And 1/2 cup of pumpkin seeds.
Half a cup pumpkin
now,
seeds.
Now, doesn't it sound a little good now when you look at all the other stuff in there, too? As I said, think of it as filler time.
Yeah.
So in a small bowl, whisk together the Dijon mustard, honey, and sherry vinegar. Slowly add the olive oil, whisking continuously. Season with some salt and pepper. Then in a large bowl, toss the kale with the dressing, using your hands to massage the kale after you wash them. About, you know, a little bit until it's nice and tender. You want to get that. You don't want to just toss it with a spoon here. You know, it's going to take a couple of minutes to get the stuff into the kale because it doesn't pick it up right away. Then toss in the apple, the cheddar, and the chicken. Garnish with pumpkin seeds. Serve in a nice bowl, and you've got a wonderful, wonderful, delicious salad, about 370 calories roughly. So 350 to 400 calories in this salad. You've got chicken, you've got cheddar, not a lot, but enough to give you some good nutrition and good protein, because when we look from a protein point of view, you've got about 33% of the protein you need from the chicken that's in this, and of course, the cheese.
And if you want, you can use nice mixed greens instead of the kale.
Yeah, you can actually use mixed greens instead of the kale.
You can't call it a kale salad, though.
No, you'd have to change the name of it. There you go. You would have to change the name. Now, if you want a copy of this, how do you think you would get it, Tom?
Let me think.
Trying to do Jeopardy.
You're
going to
print
well.
One out and give it to me.
That is not the way it is. You're going to have to go to our website, zorbapastor.org. You can see pictures of Tom, pictures of me, go through a bunch of other things. That's zorbapastor.org. Or don't forget, you can find us on Facebook.
800-462-7413 if you'd like to talk with Zorba. And a listener now, Zorba, in Knoxville, Tennessee. Hi.
Hello.
How can we help?
Well, I have a question about aging. I'm very, very active. I'm 66 years old, and I've been a marathon runner and a long-distance cyclist for years. Then about 4 years ago, suddenly I couldn't exercise. And I realized something was wrong, and I talked to my friend, the cardiologist, and I had a cath, and I had a 98% blockage of my LAD. I had a stint, and in a few months, I felt better. Then about 6 months to 9 months later, I realized I couldn't run again. And this time, I was placed on Lipitor, and I stopped it, and 6 months later, I was fine again. Then, suddenly, once again, I couldn't run my normal 6 miles. I couldn't bike the way I wanted to.
Mm-hmm.
And I talked to my cardiologist, and he said, well, I think you probably have another heart blockage because it sounds like what happened to you before.
Mm-hmm.
So this spring, I had a cardiac cath. And I had a stress echo, and really it came out okay. My stent was not blocked, and my echo didn't show any type of strain.
Okay.
But I still couldn't exercise. Actually, I canceled the ski trip. I was afraid I was going to have a heart attack.
Oh.
Then I thought about it. When they stopped my Lipitor about a year ago, they started me on Crestor. And I really want to know, what would make a 66-year-old's performance status drop drastically? Could it be the Crestor?
Sure.
Or am I just getting old? Or can you think of something else my doctors are not thinking about?
Let's talk about this. 66 is not old. 66 is the new 36. That's the way we think about it. But it actually is very interesting because data came out in JAMA, published just a few weeks ago, that showed when you look at the data from 1968 to the year 2013, there has been nearly a 40% drop in death rate in people under the age of 75. That is monumental. That is a monumental change that has never occurred before. And a lot of that has to do with lifestyle, technology, and so on. So let's look at what you have. First of all, yes, you are 66. So we'll put that to the side. You can't change that. But you're a performance guy. You've done marathons. You've done biking. You went in. You initially found out that you had a blockage that, once again, you know, exercise is not the total panacea. It does help, but genetics also runs its risk. And the reality is you had good medical care, a stent was put in, and you're still living. So you've got a new lease on life, and you got better. And then you had a stress echo. Stress echo is a really good way of looking how the heart actually performs. It's a wonderful test. It's non-invasive because it looks at how it's actually performing when you're stressed. And the stress echo showed your heart was doing really well. It was pumping out the right amount of blood that you needed for that time. So now we have to look back and say, okay, why am I still suffering? So my recommendation is, I think statins are great drugs, but statins have problems for some people. So you may be suffering from the statin. We know that statins produce muscle aches and myalgias, and for some people it's bad. So let me go back one step. First of all, why'd you cancel the ski trip? Skiing is life. You were worried. You were worried about dying on the hill. You were feeling pretty bad.
I was worried I was going to drop dead on the spokes with my daughter and wife next to me, and it just wouldn't have been good form. So I sent my daughter and her boyfriend off without me, and I had the. And I had the test.
Yeah, it would be good for him. I certainly agree with you. That would not be good. So let's look at how we now figure this out. I mean, that's really the way it is. So my first recommendation is get off all the statins. Do not take a statin. Give yourself a good four-week to six-week to eight-week period off the statin and see how you feel. That's what I would do. Are you going to cause yourself some harm? Maybe. I mean, statins are good in the long run, but it doesn't – I mean, it's not like stopping a blood pressure pill where there's a danger. It's just in the long run. Then if you find out you're great, you go, hey, my symptoms are better. I can exercise. It's easy for you to test because just start running and doing your bike. You'll be able to tell right away. Then the question is this true of all statins or just some statins? So why did they switch you from Lipitor to Crestor?
Because I had such pain in my legs after 40 minutes of running. I had to stop, and I actually had my back injected because I had such discomfort in my back. And then I realized that, gee, maybe it's not my back or my legs. Mm-hmm. Maybe it is, I see patients all day, and I don't know if I'm much of a Lipitor, but I know they cause myalgia. So that's why I stopped it. I can't remember how long I was off it, but I got back to where I was.
So you should stop. You should stop the Crestor. Stop the statins and see how you feel. Now, let's make an assumption. There are a couple of issues. If you stop the statin, if you've tried two statins, such as the Lipitor and Crestor, I would probably try simvastatin and see if that did it. If it causes the same problem, then the question is, will a lower dose solve the problem? So for some people, for instance, on Lipitor, the high dose is 80 milligrams. And I have some people who are on 10 milligrams every other day and they don't have any muscle aches. That's how low the dose is. And they can handle that. And it's still useful. I have other people who are on 5 milligrams a day or 10 milligrams a day and they don't have a problem. And then I have other people where it doesn't make a difference at all. They can't tolerate statins. It ruins their quality of life and they don't take it. So, A, stop the statin. B, if you find you're much better, try a different statin, such as simvastatin. C, if that one doesn't, causes the problems, then go back and see if a low dose will make a difference. I think this is a statin problem. Let us know. Send us an email, post it on Facebook, or give us a call and let us know what happens. I think this is a statin issue. You've had the workup. The statin is the next step. Getting rid of it.
You think 3 months will do it?
I would do it. I think you may find a difference in 2 to 4 weeks, but for some people, it takes a while to work out of your system. And then, like I said, you then do some other tests to see what's going on in terms of other drugs, A, or B, the dosage, and C, if not, you don't tolerate it. Well, if it were me and it ruined my quality of life, I would try something else, but I would do diet and exercise if I could not tolerate a statin. Let us know what happens. Good luck.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you so much for the call at 800-462-7413. 800-462-7413. And before the break, Sorba, let's take a quick email question from a listener, Jackie, who listens to the show on WBAA in West Lafayette, Indiana. She writes, "Hi, Dr. Sorba. Do you have a recommendation for taking basic vitamin and mineral supplements? I'm thinking that diet, age, gender, etc. would all have a bearing on this, but in general, are there some sort of rules to follow?"
Well, that is the $64,000 question, as we would say. Mm-hmm. The Annals of Internal Medicine came out with an editorial about a year and a half ago, maybe it was even up to 2 years ago, that it's time to stop this nonsense, that there is no evidence, long-term evidence at all, that middle-aged people, we'll just leave middle-aged people as middle-aged people, taking a multivitamin have any less disease than people who do not take a multivitamin. In other words, there's no evidence that multivitamins make a difference.
You used to take a multivitamins.
I used to take them, and I threw them out.
Yeah.
Then there are some other studies recently that show, and I do take vitamin D. I think vitamin D is useful, 2,000 milligrams a day, which is 2,000 units a day. And then vitamin D3. And then there's been some evidence recently that folic acid, we know it's important for women of childbearing potential before they get pregnant, and because during early pregnancy, it cuts down on birth defects. But that folic acid may also, once again, reduce the risk of stroke or heart attacks, but it was not a huge monumental study. I have to admit, I have stopped taking a multivitamin, but periodically things come up and say, you know, maybe a multivitamin is useful. It's cheap. It's inexpensive. If you want to take a supplement, I think you do no harm by taking a multivitamin that says 100% of your minimum daily requirements. USP, U.S. Pharmacopoeia, means it dissolves right, and it costs you probably about $10 to $15 a year. And if that makes you feel better, do it.
Have a question for the good doc? Zorba is here to help. Just post it to our Facebook page or send it along in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
Some research coming up. We'll talk about it. More of your calls, of course, later on, our medical myth buster here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRI, Public Radio International. Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. That toll-free number again is 800-462-7413. But before we take our next call, Zorba, the FDA has some guidelines on sugar.
Yes, sugar. How are we going to get less sugar in what we're eating? Clearly, we are an obese society. A lot of that is due to sugar.
Yep.
When the low-fat crisis hit, remember Snackwells? Do you remember those cookies called Snackwells about 20 years ago? They were a hit because they were low-fat cookies and they were filled with carbohydrates. That's what they were.
Mm-hmm.
So the FDA has a goal. It says, let's get rid of added sugars. In other words, sugars that we don't actually add but actually are in the foods that we eat.
Yep.
And the beverages that we drink. So they want a label. They want us to get to basically 10% of our calories should come from added sugars, no more than that. That's roughly 12 teaspoons of sugar. That, to me, that's still a lot of sugar.
We're talking about per day?
Per day, but actually that's a can of Coke. A can of Coke has 12 teaspoons of sugar. And there's sugar lurking in a whole bunch of foods that have, if you will, the picture of goodness, such as yogurt. Yogurt. When you think of yogurt, you think of health. A lot of yogurt has added sugar.
Yeah.
Or you think of granola. Granola's like, wow, granola, I'm really doing a good job. It's really healthy for me. It has added sugar. And whole grain bread, it has added sugar. And pasta sauce, obviously in canned foods and prepared soups and salad dressings. There are all these hidden sugars. So the FDA says, we want you to label this, and we want you to we're going to make a recommendation, then we may actually make a rule, that you have to label there are so many calories of added sugar into your product.
Don't things have labels on that say how much
of
this and
First of all, the labels are confusing. You know, the food industry clearly has taken the lead on this. If you look at it, it says number of servings. It's in a very small number.
Yeah.
And so it turns out that for some things, I was looking at one package and a serving, and it was a serving and a half. Yeah. So it was like it wasn't two servings in the package, and it wasn't one serving. It was one and a half servings. You know, you look at potato chips. It's like 12 chips or 14 chips. It should be a bag or half a bag.
Yeah, right.
This issue is, if you want to reduce the sugar in your diet, it should be labeled, and we should start getting used to eating things with less sugar. It actually starts to taste good.
But
we start to
wouldn't
taste the
sugar industry say we already label it, and if you use more of that than we recommend, that's up to you, not up to
us? Well, I think what the FDA is saying, it's more that when you get above 10%, you have to begin to label this. In other words, you want to label a can of Coke and say it has. Now, Coke, we know it has a lot of sugar. But would you think of yogurt as having a fair amount of sugar? It's got to be labeled because most people don't even realize it's there. It's truth in labeling so that you, the consumer, are able to make bright decisions. comes, and we need to have more of it. And I'm glad to see the FDA is finally taking good steps.
800-462-7413, the number to call if you have a question for Zorba. And back to the phones we go now, Zorba, a listener with us in Madison, Wisconsin. Hi.
Hi.
How can we help?
Well, I wake up each morning. Well, first I'll tell you that I'm a 74-year-old mm-hmm. woman, mm-hmm. so I know my body changes as I got older. But I have a curious problem where each morning when I wake up, and this has gone from occasionally to almost every day, my right hand, the index finger and thumb, it's not numb, it's kind of a tingling that goes on, and it's very irritating. And
okay, so you've got a tingling on your index finger on your thumb occurring mostly during the morning when you wake up or during the day?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. It occasionally comes during the day, but mostly it's infuriating when I wake up in the morning because I think that's what wakes me up.
Oh, yeah. It must be terrible. Well, yeah. So what do you do for it? How do you get rid of it?
I shake it because I'm thinking it's circulation problem mm-hmm. or something, yeah. and yeah. then I realize it may be some arthritis or whatever, yeah. but it's just kind of a massage down yeah. the Hi. Index and the thumb.
So it's kind of electrical? Is that what it feels like?
I don't know what that feels like. My first thought is kind of a numbness, but it's a tingling with it.
It's a tingling. Okay, well, yeah. first of all, I don't think it's circulation.
Oh.
You know, remember when you were young and you sat down on the floor when you were really young and your foot fell asleep and you could hardly stand up?
Yes.
You remember those days. That's circulation. That's when you cut off the circulation, you know, in your leg and your foot. That hasn't happened to me in years, you know, when you would sit in a funny way and not notice it and all of a sudden you'd go, my God, I can't stand up.
Yeah. And that was kind of my first thought because I sleep on my back. I mm-hmm. have a CPAP now and it kind of forces me to sleep on my back. But I've gotten accustomed to it and actually love it. So I'm not sleeping on that side,
yeah.
so you're right.
I think it's more neurological. It's more nerve. And you may have something like carpal tunnel. It may not be carpal tunnel, but it may be like carpal tunnel. And it may be from pressure on a nerve that is then tingling. That's what it sounds like to me. It sounds more like that. I've got a quick suggestion on what you might try. You can go to the store and you can get wrist splints. People use them for all sorts of things. You go to Walgreens, Walmart, Target, CVS, and you look for a wrist splint, and you put that on at night and see what happens. Sometimes just if your hand is in a neutral position throughout the evening, it'll go away. And if that's your answer, that's a simple fix. You know, no surgery involved, no medication to take. I would try that out. It sounds more like a nerve issue than a circulatory issue.
Thank you. And one more little thing.
Sure.
I would listen to your show just to hear you laugh. I love it.
That's very kind of you.
Have a wonderful day. Have a wonderful day.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for the call. 800-462-7413.
You know, I have to tell you something. It was recently in Montana. Wonderful. I was in Big Sky. Gave a wonderful, wonderful discussion about longevity. And I like to do that. I go around, lecture around the country mm-hmm. on longevity. And at the end of the time, a couple of people came up to me. The first thing one of the people said was, "Where's Tom?" And I think they think that we're connected at the waist. Like, you know, we're like Abbott and Costello, who really were not connected, and Dean Martin and Jerry Lewis, who hated each other and all that other stuff. But I said, "He's not here." And then they said, "How come you didn't laugh like you do on the air?" And I thought, you know, when I'm standing up and talking about it, I can't laugh. I mean, it's a spontaneous thing.
Oh, yeah, it has to be spontaneous.
It's got to be spontaneous. Yeah. So something sets it off. And obviously for this woman, it helped her. And that was very sweet. Yeah, thanks, Tom. Appreciate it.
Zorba, time again now for our Medical Mythbusters segment. Today's question is from a listener named Margaret, who listens to the show on KRPS in Pittsburgh, Kansas. She writes, "Dear Dr. Pastor, someone told my niece that dyeing your child's hair will help prevent getting head lice. True or false?"
It will not help you prevent getting head lice at all. It's not the way you prevent head lice. It doesn't make any difference dyeing your hair at all. Preventing from getting head lice is not getting in contact with another kid who has head lice. That's how you prevent it. And then treating it with a comb, you know, that gets out the nits. And then treating it with the appropriate over-the-counter medication. There are a whole bunch of medicines now on the market, over-the-counter. They work. Nix. There are other medications that work. and they contain, I think it's permethrin. I can't remember exactly what they contain. Mm-hmm. But the over-the-counter stuff is very, very effective. You know, the way they used to treat it in the 50s, do you know what they used to do?
No.
In the classroom? They'd shave the hair
of all the kids. That's right, yeah.
Not just the boys, but the girls.
Yeah.
And you can just imagine that was the way they did. And then a whole bunch of folk remedies like put mayonnaise in your hair. Imagine what that'll smell like by the end of the day. Mayonnaise doesn't work. Comb the hair, put on the medicine, but don't dye the hair. It will not keep the lice away.
Have a possible myth you're dying to ask Zorba? He's good at separating the truth from the lies.
Oh, gosh, I can't believe that. What a joke.
So how do people get in touch?
You know what? I bet they could go on the internet. Go to ZorbaPastor.org. They could post it on Facebook. Follow my occasional tweets. I mean, how much time does one have to tweet, follow Facebook, answer email? How about face-to-face interactions? Hey, the good old way. They can just shout at me on the street.
Yeah. Or if you're driving, they could run and see if they could catch up.
I love it. I love it.
800-462-7413. And a listener with us now, Zorba, in Marion, Indiana. Hi.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Dr. Zorba. And I do follow you on Facebook, and I love it. I love your show. And I have a question for you. I'm scheduled for a procedure, but I'm having moments of high anxiety over this, and a sense of well-being is very disturbed. On a recent visit to my doctor, she noticed my ankles were swollen, discolored, and sent me to a vein specialist. And my question is about the safety of radio frequency ablation with ultrasound-guided sclerotherapy. Is this really safe? And how do I know if that's really necessary?
So are you talking about to remove your veins? Is that what you're talking about?
That's right.
What's going on? Do you have some symptoms or you don't like the color of the veins? Why are you having this done?
Well, over the last 2 years, I'm starting to have some leg pain. I'm very active, 64-year-old woman. I hike and do the treadmill, things like that. And my ankles have started to discolor. Mm-hmm. Veins bulging out and my ankles look pretty bad.
Uh-huh.
And the skin's starting to hurt there. And, mm-hmm. and my doctor thought that this was probably from those veins,
mm-hmm.
and that was all new to me. So this is what I'm going through now, and I'm just wondering, is this a procedure I should have done?
Yeah, there are a couple of very important issues here. So the first decision on whether or not you have a procedure done, such as this, with your veins, is the symptoms. So for some women, if they have big veins in their legs and they want to get rid of it, that's an issue. It's a cosmetic issue. For others, it's how much edema or swelling is in the leg and the ankle, whether or not it's uncomfortable or not. So in terms of your symptoms, how uncomfortable is it?
It's not bad now. The skin is starting to change, get sore.
Mm-hmm.
It's just progressively, I think, getting worse, a lot worse in the last 6 months.
Okay, so your symptoms are not good. Okay, second question, there are different ways basically of destroying the veins. What they do is they're destroying the inside of the veins, and other veins then take over that work. So you don't have these big veins that swell up. You have small veins that take it over. It's not a perfect procedure. It does have some side effects, and sometimes the other small veins will produce a problem. The next question, do you know how many this doctor does?
It's a reputable vein clinic.
Okay, so it's a vein clinic that just does veins, right?
Right.
Okay, is it covered by your insurance?
Yes, insurance wants me to wear the compression garments for 6 weeks.
Okay.
And it's supposed to be covered by my insurance.
Okay, so they want you to wear compression garments to see whether or not it gets rid of your symptoms. I mean, that would be the reason behind it, because if not, then it's just worthless. Now, your doctor, was your family doctor who recommended you have the procedure done?
Yes, she saw my ankles and asked me if I would like to have that looked at, mm-hmm. and I said yes.
Okay.
So she sent me to this vein clinic.
Okay, so this is a reputable way. I think your first step is putting on the compression stockings and seeing whether or not that makes a difference. If it doesn't make a difference, you don't want to have the procedure done. If it does make a difference and it's worthwhile after 6 weeks, then you have to say, well, do I want to have the procedure or do I want to have the compression stockings all the time? And then if you want to have the procedure, you have to look at the fact of what's the cure rate. I don't have that exact number. It's probably in the 80% range. It's not in the 100% range, that much I can tell you. But it's probably in that 80 or 90% range. And this is kind of a way of stepping through a procedure that you have anxiety about. It's not a life and death procedure. You don't have to have it done. You have to decide, is it worthwhile? And process here is critical.
That's right.
Process is critical. So I think I'd do the next step of putting on the compression stockings and seeing whether or not that's the case. Now, the next step is whether or not you think it's a good clinic. It's a reputable clinic in town that just does veins, so it sounds good. You also can ask them, say, hey, I want to speak to somebody else who's had the procedure done. Can you give me the name of somebody? And most reputable clinics, if they do it, will be able to give you the name of someone who will be able to do it. And vein clinics, you want to make sure it's not just for cosmetics, that it really needs to be done.
Well, that's awesome.
Perfect.
Awesome. I knew you would help me with that. Okay.
Thanks so much. You have a great day.
You.
Glad we could help.
Yeah, we appreciate the call at 800-462-7413. Before we head out today, Zorba, let's take a quick email question from a listener, Paul, from Northern Illinois. He writes, Dr. Zorba, if my shoulder or any part of my body hurts, toothache, whatever, I take a pain pill. How does that pill know where to send its properties? I'm in Northern Illinois, but pick up your show. Thanks, and I love the show.
Well, here it is. You know, I think if you take the pill in Wisconsin, how do you know it's going to make it to him in Northern Illinois?
Yeah, I know.
That's the real issue. You know, at a distance, what's going to happen to it? Well, it's because of receptors in the body. That's a good question. You know, all the pills go into the stomach. How does a heart pill, you know, affect the heart? How does a blood pressure pill affect the blood pressure? And the body is a remarkable organ, and when we take these medicines, they go to the right place. They also go to other places, too, but the receptors there don't necessarily make a difference. In other words, when I take a heart pill, if it's going by, we'll say it's going by a muscle in my, you know, in the blood vessels in my muscle, it may not affect that at all because it doesn't have the receptors that are basically turned on or turned off by that pill or affected. These are proteins that affect, that are very important in terms of medical effects. So the bottom line answer is magic.
Have a question for the good doc. Zorba is here to help. Just post it to our Facebook page or send it along in an email, too.
Zorba@WPR.org. Don't forget you can post it on Facebook. And if you really have an important question that I can't answer, I'll just find the genie in Aladdin's lamp, rub the lamp, and the genie will come up, and that's magic, and we'll get the answer.
Zorba, we'll see you next time.
Stay well, Tom.
If you missed anything during the show or just want to download our show podcast, visit us on the web
at zorbapastor.org or post it on Facebook.
And don't forget you can call us anytime at 800-462-7413. Zorba Pastor on Your Health is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's not intended as a medical diagnosis, so please do check with your doc. Our executive producer is Carl Christensen, and our technical director is Brad Kohlberg. Our theme music is by Leo and Ben Sidran. For Zorba Pastor, I'm Tom Clark, expecting your company on the next Zorba Pastor on Your Health.
Copies of today's show are available through the radio store at 800-747-7444. Ask for program number 1205Z. More information on Zorba, his clinic, and healthy living, including heart-healthy recipes, podcasts, and show archives, is available online at zorbapastor.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.